Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm delighted, absolutely delighted to be joined this evening by Joanna Fortune, who is the author of 15-Minute Parenting and also is a highly experienced and qualified clinician in the field of psychotherapy. And she's over 20 years of clinical experience and specializes in trauma recovery therapy and is also a parent herself. Joanna, thanks so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to this conversation. I did have to start by saying that I am a bit starstruck with you. I listen to your Moncrief parenting slot, myself and my wife do, and it's always like, yeah, that's really good, really good. We'll try and remember that the next time. No, forget it. And then we have another blow up. And it's like, oh no.
Because when you're in the moment, isn't it? It's like when you're in the moment, it's all about the emotions. It's all about, you know, what your emotions are calling the shots instead of all that clever stuff you read and heard and you stored up cognitively. When we flip our lids, no different to our kids. When we flip our lids, that part of the brain that recalls information, it's offline. It's gone.
It's so true. So true. It's like, yeah, that's it. The emotions start bubbling up and just the whole logic goes out the window. And I am locked in battle as a three-year-old with a three-year-old.
But always remember, they can go much louder and longer than we can. So that's a battle you're not going to win ever.
That is absolutely true. Yeah. If only I could tell myself, I always say that to my wife, that I should put up like these post-it notes all over the house. When this happens, remember this, because inevitably, like, I have four kids and still on the fourth one, I'm doing the same mistakes I did all the way through. And I'm like,
but at least you're consistent, so they can't tell each other later, you know, you had a different kind of experience than we did. It was the same for all of them. I'll positively reframe it all, Rory. Don't worry.
That's very true. Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. But listen, this is the third podcast, Surviving Parenting in Lockdown. And we put these podcasts together to try, I suppose, just give parents a support in this period. It's a very, very difficult one. And we know our listeners, there's lots of our listeners who are parents, but even those who aren't, who are teachers, who are childcare workers, people engaged, you know, they want to hear, and it's important to hear about the experience of parenting now with, you know, with school online and all those things. And the challenge of what it means in terms of supports required for policymakers. And if you do have any questions, we're going to be doing more of these parenting in the lockdown, because unfortunately this lockdown is going to go on. You can contact us, myself on Twitter at Rory Hearn, or at Reboot Republic on Twitter, and you can message it and we will raise it. And hopefully we'll have Joanna back as well, but with others as well. And just to say, in terms of my own experience first, like, I have a teenager who is in transition year, who misses his friends. I have a junior infant who would talk the hind leg off a chair, but starts to squeak talking like a chipmunk when the Zoom class comes on, has this really strange change and loses concentration after 15 minutes. And of course, a toddler who requires constant attention. And I'll tell you a funny story about last night. At 4 o'clock in the morning, the toddler needed a nappy change, which is unusual, but was shouting and roaring from a room telling us this. But of course, we were like, I should go back to sleep. No, half an hour later, still not asleep. So we take her into the bed, change the nappy. And of course, then for her, it's wakey, wakey time.
Yeah.
And she starts listing out her family. And her family is mama, dada, Peppa, George.
And we're like,
oh no, this is the result of a lockdown child that watches too much Peppa Pig at age one. So it's funny, but it does kind of say, I think that there's a lot of people are really struggling with work. I think stress and anxiety, like, I talk to other parents as well, you know, snapping at the kids. You know, we're all stuck in the house. And of course, we're privileged. You know, you think of other people who are in overcrowded housing, or frontline workers not seeing their kids, or people trying to manage childcare, kids with additional needs, and the homeless, of course, at worst, trying to, you know, homeschool from an emergency accommodation or a homeless hub. And I think the lockdown exposes how we are all in this storm, but we've massively different boats. And it does expose the huge inequalities that parents face. So maybe, Joanna, just to start, for parents who are struggling and parents maybe who are not struggling, who are just wondering, you know, how can they get through this? What would be your kind of key bits of advice for surviving parenting in lockdown?
Yeah, I think, gosh, there's so much in what you said there that immediately brings to mind that you're absolutely right. While we're all experiencing lockdown, how we are experiencing it is completely different and unique to each of us. And of course, that's enshrined within the circumstances we each live in. And, you know, I'm really struck there by what you were saying, like, what's the key thing to surviving this? And for me, it is about starting. You need a mantra in mind. It's good enough is good enough. It's effort over outcome. And those are things I say all of the time when we're speaking about children and, you know, trying to raise children with self-esteem and confidence. And it's always, you know, focus on effort over outcome, praise their effort over outcome. And now I'm saying, do you know what? Give that back to yourself. Mm. So really, what we all have to do in this is try our best, whatever that means to each of us, and give ourselves credit for the efforts we're putting into this. Like, really, hopefully, we don't know, of course, but hopefully our schools will reopen, you know, early February or as soon as possible, as soon as it's safe. And our teachers, always hold in mind, our teachers are highly skilled, trained professionals. They will get our children back on track academically. What we can do to support that transition and process is focus on ensuring our children go back as calm, emotionally regulated, and not stressed or anxious, because that's going to make the learning transition even more difficult. And why I'm saying that is that mixed in with our supported learning, home-based learning experience now, is that we ensure our children are getting time to play, to move, to run about. I was really intrigued what you said there about your little guy, you know, doing his chipmunk voice and 15-minute window of tolerance for the online. And I'm going, of course, because things move really quickly in a five-year-old's life. And actually sitting and looking at people through a screen, it's a great short-term solution. Like, and we're lucky we have that technology available to us, but it's not the same, nor can it replace in-person, intersubjective, meaningful connection. And so there's a bit of a, oh, I see you all, I don't really see you all, and I can't touch you all, and we're not really together. I'm over it. Yeah. But also after about 15 minutes, children of that age need a movement break. They're done sitting still. They're not built to sit still at the best of times. So it's really about, with our home learning, short bursts and structuring the day or the period of time about learning to get through it. And, you know, I think when we say to our children, sit down there now for 10 minutes and do your maths or whatever it is. I mean, time is such an abstract notion for young children that we may as well say, sit down there now for 2 weeks. We're going to do maths, because it just doesn't mean anything. So, and again, if we put the, you know, the timers on our phones or even the oven clock to go bing, that's happening to your child. The noise happens and it's over, but they didn't get to see the time going. I tend to use, you know, the visual sand timers, like a big, like a big egg timer. I have a 15-minute one and say, when all the sand hits the bottom, we're done with our school. Or when all the sand hits the bottom, we get to run around outside and play chasing or whatever it is that you're breaking the day up with. But then they see the time going. They can see I've got lots of time, middle amount of time, little time, it's over. And they're regulating with it. But it also lets them know, I'm only going to have to do this till the sand hits the bottom, and then I can do something else. So it helps to keep them engaged. Structure is key, but also giving ourselves credit and staying off those parent WhatsApp groups and your social media where everyone just seems to be nailing it. And you know, it can be really hard to say, oh my gosh, I didn't do any of that fun stuff with my kid, or I didn't do any of that today. Focus on what you did do. You got up, you got something done. And good enough is good enough.
And what, explained that idea, because like I've heard it before, and that idea of good enough parenting, and it, to a certain extent, it seems empty or feels empty to me. You know, what does it actually mean? Or what are you trying to sort of say to us parents when you say
that? It's really about saying that perfection isn't good enough. This kind of pursuit of perfection that does permeate parenting these days. And it may be, you know, in some way, life through a lens and looking at the glossy online social media type of parenting, that veneer, you know, that can be applied, that things look perfect. But actually, you know, I would always say stay away from a pursuit of perfection, because perfection doesn't allow for learning. Mistakes allow for learning. Getting it sometimes wrong and mostly right most of the time allows for you to go, do you know, that wasn't my finest moment. And actually, you know, child 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, whatever age they are, even your teenagers, saying to them, do you know, things actually got a bit hot in there and I lost my temper. Or to your younger child saying, my feelings got really big and they got really loud and I shouted. I wish I hadn't. Can I get a do-over? And here's what I wish I had done or said instead. That's good enough parenting. That's about saying, sometimes I make mistakes, but I know how to do relational repair. I know how to come in and make it better. Because then we're modeling for our children that it's okay to get it wrong. You can learn from that. And more than that, our relationship and relationships you have with others are stronger than these hiccups along the way. And you can make repair and get back on track, because actually that's what parenting is about, isn't it? It's about you're out of sync and you're getting back into sync. And not just once a day, multiple times a day. You could even apply that to your partner, never mind your kids. Like, we're in sync, we're out of sync. That's just the way it goes.
Absolutely. No, and it is a really interesting idea, because you know, that we are kind of sold and told, and, you know, we see it in social media, but we have it of ourselves, you know, that everything should be just going along okay. And that, you know, I find, you know, when you blow up, and I know other, you know, parents have the same, that, you know, you snap at your kids and you're like, this idea then of repairing. And of course, as you say, it parallels, it really can be very challenging when you're not, you know, you're not in terms of yourself very worked out, or you're, you know, this idea of even going to your child and saying, as you said there, you know, I'm sorry about that. Like that, even that idea of you feel you're somehow acknowledging that you're not this, you know, authoritative figure, that you actually, I'm just like you, and you feel, you know, is that actually the parent-child relationship? Or, you know, that could be very challenging.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's one of the things that I always do with parents I'm working with is something I call the parental self-audit. You know, it's about taking that journey inwards to discover the buttons, because, you know, by the time, and this is, I really think this is true for most of us, by the time we snap at our children or yell at them or whatever it is, it's rarely because of what they've done or said. It's because of what got activated or triggered within us by them doing or saying the thing. So that's about us. Our reaction comes from somewhere in us. Okay. And I think, you know, and we all have different relationships with each of our children. I know you want to say it's always the same. It's not. And it can't be, because you have to pause and actually say to yourself, you know, what does this dynamic remind me of? Like when I'm feeling this and I'm yelling, what other relationship in my life comes to mind? Who are you for me? Who am I for you? And how do I feel about that? You know, I'd often say to a parent, you know, and even now listening, just ask and answer. We're great as parents for asking ourselves questions. We're not so great at answering them. But say, you know, who does your child remind you of in your life? And how do you feel about that person or your relationship with that person? Because sometimes when our buttons are those emotional buttons inside us, when they're being triggered, sometimes what we're responding from is a relationship that belongs elsewhere. So understanding our own triggers, understanding our limitations, and not saying, gosh, I must fix that, but just saying, yeah, I know, I get that about myself. I know this. You're bringing a conscious awareness to it. So it's not an unconscious button anymore. You're interweaving it with narrative. You're able to think and talk about it. And now you're consciously aware of what gets activated in you. So the primary change occurs in you, and your child benefits from it, as opposed to focusing on children's overt behavior and saying, we're going to focus on changing what you do. Instead, I'm going to change how I react to what you do.
Yeah, no, it's very true, isn't it? So much of the parenting is, you know, and we talk about children all the time, and the children's behavior is actually stems from us as the parent.
Absolutely.
And, you know, what is our approach? Where are we at? And you're right. Often we are just responding out of our own traumas and our own places of hurt and our own, you know, automatic, isn't it called automatic, or, you know, passive parenting, that how we were parented, and not actually actively engaging with thinking, how do I want to be a parent?
Yeah.
Or how do I? And of course, it's in the stressful times, which we are in now in lockdown, that where all that stress, you know, the conscious parenting, the, you know, thinking through, you don't have the time for it. You don't have the space for it. So how do you do it at the time like this? That's so stressful. And
It is so difficult. And, you know, even if we are not listening and saying, oh, I don't have an explicit conscious trauma or a life event, actually, we all have an experience of being parented. And that's not to say, you know, don't worry, you can always blame someone else, blame your parents. It's really about looking at, you know, how did you experience being parented? And I always think it's nice to kind of ask yourself, you know, how do you wish you were responded to in your times of distress as a child? You know, when you were upset, or if you were in trouble, or you were being disciplined, how was that for you? And how do you wish it had been? And maybe you're saying, I wish it was exactly like it was. Fantastic. Or maybe you're saying, no, I wish it was a different way. Use that as your starting point.
Most of us who grew up in 1980s Ireland.
we could say it could have been a little bit different.
Could have been a little bit better. You know, emotional literacy wasn't high on the agenda.
No, it was, you know, do as you're told because I said so. You know, there was the different type of parenting mantra. Yeah. But now you can say, well, look, here's how I wish it was done. And that's how, where I'm going to start from. But I also think, you know, I'm not an advocate, as you know, of timeouts for children. I don't think they work. There's a whole load of reasons why they don't. But I wouldn't rule them out for us parents. I think sometimes we benefit from taking 10 minutes for ourselves to ground ourselves, to exhale before we respond, recognizing when it's getting a little heated, recognizing when you haven't quite flipped your lid, but the lid is loose, okay? And you know what comes next. And being able to say, never just walk away from your child because they're going to just think you're ignoring them or rejecting them, but saying, actually, I'm about to lose my temper. I really need to take 10 minutes to cool down before we talk about this. And in some of our homes, we all know that means locking yourself in the bathroom and just trying to, you know, clamor 10 minutes of alone time somewhere. But sometimes, you know, especially depending on the age or developmental stage of your child, they may go, it's in my interest to give you that 10 minutes. I'll stay over here while you do that. But you've already said, I'm coming back to you to talk about this. So not I'm going away, leave me alone, but I need this time and I'm coming back. Taking windows to ground ourselves during the day is a survival strategy and a self-care strategy during this. And I do those, like, I mean, I have a small child, as I was saying to you. So getting time alone is, you know, an ideal. It's not a reality, but it's an ideal. But I can, you know, maybe set up something that will occupy and distract her even for a minimum amount of time. And in that, take, you know, the tea or coffee while it's actually still hot and just turn and look out of a window. Because changing the field of vision helps to reset a busy, agitated brain. And looking out of a window is a way of changing a field of vision for ourselves very quickly. And in less than 1 minute, I can look out that window and find and name 5 things that I can see, 4 things I can hear, 3 things I could touch, 2 things I could smell, 1 thing I could taste. So I'm doing 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, engaging my senses, changing the field of vision, sipping a hot cup of whatever. And that's a grounding exercise in less than a minute that will just help me go, exhale, come down. And I might come down to a nice, you know, calm resting space, but I'll certainly de-escalate from an agitated space. Because when we're in that, when we're any of us, children, adults, when any of us are aroused by fear, anxiety, anger, that kind of emotion, we become like emotional meerkats. You know, we go into a state of anticipatory arousal where we're just looking for signs that we're right to feel the way that we do. Don't we all love to be right about things? I mean, do you know what? If you've ever had a bruise and you know it hurts, but you keep touching it to make sure it still hurts, it's exactly that impulse that when I'm in that kind of heightened emotional anticipatory state, I'm just looking for signs that I am right to feel the way that I do. I am right to be irritated. I am right to be angry. It is always me doing the home learning. It is always me doing the housework. It is always me doing whatever, because that feeds the emotional state that I'm in. And it's a hop, skip and a jump. Then I flip my lid and I'm yelling at somebody. Having techniques that we can very quickly de-escalate. And I do a lot of these with adolescents, you know, because I work with adolescents who, many of whom experience anxiety. You know, we could talk about that maybe another stage about adolescence and anxiety. But I'm also aware that our teenagers, they're not with us all day. They're in school or they're with their peers. So I would, and some of the techniques that I do with them would be applicable here. I would say, you know, in school, if you feel yourself something coming on and you're not feeling grounded and you're not feeling secure, excuse yourself to the bathroom, take a square of toilet roll, pin it to the door with your index finger, take a deep breath. And as you remove your finger, exhale and use your breath to hold the toilet roll square to the door or the wall. And basically repeat that 3 times. So basically you're saying take 3 deep breaths. But in the history of being stressed out, if anyone says, take a deep breath and calm down, I mean, that just makes you even more stressed and irritated. So by making it a focus on the toilet roll or something like that, you know, I'll often talk about a clam cuddle, you know, cross, you know, opposite hand to opposite shoulder and squeeze as tight as you can for a count of 5, release and repeat that 3 times. You've basically given yourself a deep pressure, proprioceptive input, a hug that's going to help you to relax your muscles. Contain, release, contain, release. So there's lots of practical things that you can do very quickly in the bathroom, looking out a window, less than 1 minute, that will help take the edge off. And I think we all need some of those in our repertoires at the moment while we're parenting through this pandemic.
Yeah, no, I think that it's very, very, you know, useful and interesting. And, you know, I think that the listeners will find that, you know, something just worth and listening back to as well in terms of, you know, taking through and taking that moment. Just to broaden it a little bit, do you listen to, we did the podcast the other day with a number of parents, including lone parents, and, you know, they talked a lot about, you know, just, I suppose, trying to survive again.
Yeah.
And I know I asked you to have a listen to it and you very kindly did.
I loved it. I actually loved it. Yeah, I really appreciate
your reflections on it and any thoughts you had.
Yeah, I mean, I actually really appreciated the raw honesty of the women who spoke. I thought they spoke really beautifully and openly, but about their lived experiences. And there were so much. I mean, I heard a couple of the contributors during it going, oh, I'm nodding while you're speaking. And I wanted to say, hey, I'm nodding while I'm listening, because there was so much that really resonated. And it just reminded me that, you know, how great it would be if we had more female representation, because if any or all of those women run for election tomorrow, I'll certainly vote them in. Because it was, what struck me was, it wasn't just people sitting around saying this is a struggle and that's a struggle. It was very solution focused. Everybody who spoke said, here's my experience of lockdown one, and here's where I'm at now. And for some of us, it was easier then and tougher now, or tougher then and easier now. But it was all lessons learned. And here's what I did about it. And these were my challenges, but here's how I overcame it. And that really struck me as something that I think women do. I think lots of parents do it in general. But I think it was very clear that in parenting alone, you know, is extremely challenging, because, and I was really struck by one of your contributors said that time when children weren't allowed to go to supermarkets. And I even remember that myself going, my first thought being, what is a single parent to do? Like, literally, what are they to do? And it really brought up for me about how, and look, it's not new information, but it's no harm that we remind ourselves in these times that we're living in, even beyond the pandemic, you know, and everything else that's going on in the media, that we just don't value caring. Yeah. We just don't. It's been an ongoing problem. It has been amplified in this pandemic. Children with additional needs, carers, single parents, and, you know, parents who are trying to work outside of home, but do that within home. But by the way, here we are when we're supposed to be parenting our children like we're not working, working like we're not parenting, and park both of those and become a teacher for a while. And we're supposed to be wearing all of these kind of hats and pretending we're not trying to do it all at once. So I think that for me, it really brought home the highs and the lows. There was a lot of humor in it, I thought, as well. You know, it's important that we find time to laugh at ourselves and each other as well. But I loved it because of the solution focus. But it just, the take home for me was it made me sad to think, yeah, we don't care about our carers. We don't care about caring. And that's down from, you know, how childcare got overlooked in all of this, the role of childcare. And, you know, how important our children's schooling is. And, you know, I'm not saying school is childcare, but at the same time, we can't separate care from education. I would be really scared and worried if we started to say teachers aren't carers at all. I think care is an integral part of education and an integral part of how our children learn. They love their teachers. You know, they are loved by their teachers. I think it's why our kids, especially the younger ones, are really missing school and their teachers, because they know they're cared for. And as parents, we know when we send our kids into the classroom, they're being cared for while they're being educated. So I think we should value care instead of being quick to say, well, we're not carers, we're teachers, and we're not this, we're parents, we're not teachers, we're parents. Actually respecting what all of us are doing and understanding the common language is care.
It absolutely is. And it is something that I really hope comes out of this pandemic, that there is a transformative paradigm shift in that, how we value care in this country.
Oh, I hope so too. And I think it is. I mean, I think, you know, one of your contributors had talked about how, you know, we can't eat money and we can't eat GDP, you know, like we have to take care of each other. We have to value family life. And I would love, you know, like you're saying, that care becomes enshrined coming out of this, but also a real, now not a tokenistic look at this, but a real meaningful shift to family friendly work policies. also emerges from this, because by doing that, we are also saying, we understand that you are parents, we understand that you have children, and we understand and value that caring role. And I think that's really important.
Mm. And it does come back to as well, the whole, you know, and I do come back to, I think the state, it has to start with government and the state, yeah. because, you know, we control that. That is, you know, that they, that embodies our values as a society. And I think there's still a fundamental problem when we don't pay our childcare workers properly. We don't, right. you know, provide a public childcare affordable system. Like it just seems to me like you were that from the very start, from the very earliest years of children, we don't value them and we don't value their carers.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And, you know, you can't separate children from their parents. When you start to talk about a child, of course, you're talking about a parent or a caregiver as you're doing that, because children don't raise themselves, you know, and they need that wraparound collective support. And I agree with you. We need our state to provide better and broader state childcare. I think childcare should not be a just for profit business, just for profit business model. I would love to see state provided and state properly subsidized childcare. I think it would actually improve the quality. And I mean the quality for our children to thrive within, but also the quality of work relations for those who are working in the childcare field, because I think they are grossly, I won't say underappreciated, because I think parents appreciate childcare workers hugely, but they are undervalued in terms of the training they have, the expertise they have, the job they do, and how they're not paid. And we've seen that our carers, be that in childcare settings, be that in, you know, elder persons' care homes, you know, or be it with people who have additional needs, both children and adults, we have seen the importance and the vital role that carers play in society. And it is about time. And I think we can sit here, Rory, and say, you know, the government should and the government need to. And that's all true. But the government also need to be reminded by us. We need to demand, not just ask and expect and wait for, but demand better treatment and better treatment for our carers and our children, and demand our family-friendly work policies, and demand that we come out of this with fresh thinking and new perspective on what it means to function as a healthy society.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you, you know, that, and, you know, I'm delighted that you're saying it. Delighted that you're, you know, you're putting it so eloquently as well. Because I really feel it's, you know, in each of the lockdowns, particularly, there's been, you know, kind of childcare and the health system have been kind of the two things that have struck me. And of course, there's wider issues of, you know, for example, you know, inadequate, you know, welfare support, you know, people in precarious work as well. But fundamentally, and sorry, housing is the other one, in terms of, you know, how, you know, COVID has exposed, you know, the inequalities in that. And it's something I was going to ask you around, you know, the impact of parenting in, you know, homeless accommodation or in severely overcrowded accommodation, that these things sort of, that housing, health, you know, childcare, we have to, you know, in each of those lockdowns, go, okay, after this one is finished now, the debate has to move to, okay, how do we actually ensure everybody has these as minimum standards to ensure everybody can have a decent life and to bring up our children so they're not traumatized and damaged? And I know trauma is one area that you, you know, specifically look at. Like, maybe, you know, you could talk a little bit about the impact of that trauma, you know.
And particularly childhood trauma and early childhood experiences are something that I'm really invested in clinically. And actually, I've been really privileged in the last 12, maybe a little over 12 months now, to be doing a piece of work, therapeutic work, with the homeless sector and with people who are experiencing homelessness and those who work in that sector. Alongside my colleague, Janet Healy, we've been doing a therapeutic program around group theraplay and looking at, you know, one of the things that keeps coming up very much what you've said there is the challenge of parenting, even in an unhoused state of mind, you know, when you're feeling and consumed with, I cannot provide basic security for my child. And, you know, we opened by talking about good enough is good enough. But what if you're starting from a place of feeling I'm not nearly good enough, and look at what we don't have. And so, you know, not saying this is a magic cure, because actually housing and the way our homeless services are challenged at the moment as well. You know, we'd like to think that things like family hubs and are short term. We'd like to think families are living there in a transient way pending you know, permanent housing solution. But we also know that that's not the lived experience. People are living for prolonged periods of time in a type of accommodation that was not created with that in mind. And that's not good enough. But one of the things we're looking at is, can we create a playfulness? Can we create play, move away from the idea of play as a box of toys, or move away from the idea of play as a set of activities that requires a lot of props, and actually embrace the idea of play as a state of mind and way of being? And so we're doing a very particular type of play that is relational, that you can, games that you play with your face, games that you just need your own body, games for movement. So you don't need the props and the toys, but you can be very playful. And if I cannot provide for you a physical structure right now, can I provide the emotional structure within our parent-child relationship that's going to strengthen the connection? Because at the end of the day, parenting is about connection, and play fuels connection. So we're looking at kind of playful, creative, therapeutic, you know, approaches and strategies that are helpful for families who are parenting under immense pressure, be that families who are living in direct provision centers, be that families who are living in temporary homeless accommodation and are doing. And I really do believe that, with rare exception, very rare exception, thankfully, most of us are doing the very best that we can with what we have. And that's the essence of good enough. But yes, there might be some practical things that we can do that would reassure you that you can be good enough in this situation. But let's not kid ourselves that in a pandemic, living in overcrowded, with no access to open spaces, with, you know, many people sharing a smaller space, these are, it's not enough to say that's not ideal. It's actually, you know, it's not acceptable, would be where I'd go. It's not acceptable for families to be living in those conditions at any time, but to expect them to expect any of us to be, you know, parenting, you know, trying to keep everybody safe and thriving and growing, and also, by the way, be covering some kind of school curriculum and activities. I just think we have to put our hands up and say, we have let people down. We have let each other down in this pandemic. And there are people who definitely have not had anything near the level of support that they have needed and deserved to get through this. So I think some of the lessons, you know, we talked about, can we come out of this with fresh thinking, a new perspective, and taking some positives about, you know, valuing our carers and, you know, coming out of this saying family friendly policies. But I think we should come out of this a little chastened as well. We didn't do well, and what we who we haven't helped and stood by. And I don't think there has been enough consideration and provision for our families who are living in very challenging circumstances.
And I think you're, again, you know, you're absolutely correct. And it's something that, you know, I do think about all the time. And, you know, in my own research and work that I've tried to continuously highlight is that, you know, the impact on the most vulnerable of, you know, inequalities. And it's not, you know, they're not inherently vulnerable. These are people, you know, who've, it's housing situations, the, mm-hmm. you know, housing problems that have put them in this situation. It's, you know, societal inequalities. And of course, their own traumas then, which leave them, you know, and the state leaves them, you know, without the ability to, you know, get through and to get by, and they don't have the resources or, you know, that other, you know, people with incomes and higher incomes and larger supports have to get through different traumas. Something that, you know, do you think, what, you know, in your own perspective as a, you know, someone who's, you know, looked at this, researched, you know, and, you know, worked in it, what do you think, why as a society, how can a society allow these situations to happen, particularly societies that, and obviously we've seen, you know, historically how we've treated, mistreated, not just mistreated, abused, you know, poor women, you know, single mothers, the, you know, the mother and baby homes, yeah. You know, that the way the state has done it in the past, and people asked, how could people stand by and, you know, allow that happen, and hand-wringing about that. But we're doing, you know, we are still neglecting, you know, vulnerable, poor mothers in homelessness and families and individuals. And how do we still do that as a society?
Yeah, and I'm glad you said we are still doing it. And that's not in any way to detract from the atrocity and wide-scale abuse that the mother and baby homes and the, you know, tremendous work of many people, including, you know, Catherine Corliss, to bring all of that to light. And we should really appreciate that. But I don't think we should also think, gosh, that was then, not now, because actually we will have questions to answer of ourselves to our children, to our grandchildren in years to come, about how we have tolerated or allowed other things to happen. I think that will come up around direct provision. I think it will come up about housing and homelessness and people who have, you know, had to exist and try to raise families in situations that, you know, when you even try to think it out loud, you just go, how are we expecting people to do this? And we have to get away from this idea that, you know, oh, people are just looking for, you know, this or that, or it's the welfare system. Actually, it's about, and I think one of your contributors, the other podcast actually mentioned the phrase socially mobile, which I think was really important. This is about, you know, giving people what they need to mobilize and to break cycles and to make a change, a sustainable, meaningful change for them and their families for years to come, generations to come. And that's always worth doing. And that is entirely the responsibility of society. That's not these people and those people, because actually the problem with all of this, be we talking about historical practices in the institutions of mother baby institutions, I really struggle with calling those homes, to be honest with you, but because that's absolutely not what they were, and looking at direct provision and homelessness and other ways we mistreat and we don't value carers and we don't give, you know, single parents everything that they need either. But it's all coming down to the idea of othering. You know, I think when we other people, then it gives us that degree of, you know, psychological distance where we can say, oh, well, it's not us, it's them, the us and them. And, you know, we haven't even mentioned, you know, the wide scale mistreatment of the traveler community either. Absolutely. And particularly women in the traveler community as well. And who are having terrible challenges trying to raise kids as well, you know, when they don't have adequate site facilities or housing or access to what they need, running water, things like that. And of course, that's our responsibility as well. But we can say, oh, well, that's just them or just those people or over there. It's not us. And it's this whole us, this kind of we're on this side and not that side. As soon as we other people, we give ourselves permission for this stuff to happen. We give society permission to keep perpetrating this mistreatment, these abuses, these atrocities against people.
And how do you challenge that? Not even challenging it in a negative way, but how do you engender an empathy in people?
Well, empathy is the key thing. And, you know, I remember reading a study that was released by the University of Michigan. This is some years ago now, but it's really valuable because it was a 30-year study and they measured empathy levels in college entry age. So kind of 17 to 19 year olds over a 30-year period, 10-year blocks. And one thing that they noticed in the decade of the year 2000 to 2010 was a significant drop in empathy levels, like I think something like 40%, like 40. So significant drops.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to look at what does that mean for our society? And yeah, look, we could point fingers and it's causation over correlation. And we could look at, is there a role of social media? Is it about how family life restructured? Is it about something else in society? But what happened? What began to change? And I'd say it's probably, you know, D, a little of all of the above. There are many variables that bring about a significant change like that. But when we look at, you know, young people, young adults entering adulthood with significantly lower levels of empathy, and then we have to question and wonder about what impact does that have? How do we challenge and change that? And I think that's something that I've seen. You know, I think I've gone into secondary schools, invited in to do talks, and usually, you know, if a school are bringing me in to talk to students, maybe something has happened, you know, there's been an issue with maybe cyberbullying or something has been going on and I'm in to talk about things. And I remember talking about empathy with a group of teenagers and they were kind of 14, 15. And a few of them said to me, you know, what do you mean by empathy? And I was like, oh, you know, it's like feeling with people. You know, if you were crying, something in me would know that is sadness and I'd feel sad that you're sad. They were looking at me going, no, people don't do that. And I go, they really do. No, people really do this. And again, I'm not saying that to go, oh, the youth of today, far from it. You know, I don't think that at all. But I think we could learn from that because empathy doesn't just start in adulthood. It's not just something, you know, all of a sudden we're empathic. It's something that is nurtured in us. And it's nurtured from way before 14 years old. For us to be empathic 40-year-olds and care about each other in society, we have to have been empathic 14-year-olds. And for us to have achieved that, we have to have been introduced to the concept of empathy by around the age of 4. And you know this, I mean, you have little kids too, but you know when they're playing and they have the toys talk to each other, it could be two dominoes, two trains, whatever it is, and they do one voice and the other voice, and you get this lovely serve and return. I say something, the other thing says something, the, over and back. In order to be able to do that type of play, they have to be able to consider something from two perspectives at once. And that's the root of developing empathy. It's not that they nail it at 4 years old, of course, you know, but they have a capacity that then we as parents grow and nurture in them. And we have to be really mindful about how we do that and how we speak to our children. You know, that when we hear, you know, there's someone in school, listen, there's always a Sammy, a Jamie, as somebody who's always in trouble, okay? And your child will come and go, oh, wait, I tell you what they did today, and they did this and they did that and whatever it might be. And instead of kind of oohing and aahing, we could go, gosh, you know, I wonder what they feel like. I wonder what it must feel like to do something like that. Or I wonder what you're feeling before you would hit out at somebody else. And by wondering and bringing our own children deeper into what emotional and physical states underpin overt behavior in ourselves and other people, we're really nurturing a deeper understanding and appreciation for human behavior. And I think that's something that's always worth doing. But if we want to change society, we start with our children and we start with ourselves, and we do it in a very mindful, conscious way.
I took a sharp, deep intake of breath there because I was thinking, yeah, I could be doing a lot more to nurture empathy in my children, and thinking of that and both my own responses to them and also that, yes, that commentary on other people in front of them, of course, as well, you know, that we do all the time, the gossiping or the, you know, the absolutely the comments you do on others that often you just do unconsciously, you know, that you're not thinking. And of course, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, I always look in these podcasts and, you know, what I try to do always is emphasize, you know, solutions and ideas. And I think that's actually a beautiful one, that idea of we can change society by changing, you know, how we raise our children and change. And that is the germ seeds of a new society, and a better society is one where I think that idea of engendering empathy. And I do see, like, you know, it's funny when you were talking about the two toys playing. And like all my children at different points have, you know, played with different toys like that. And sometimes they'll be bashing the toys off each other. And I would go, and, you know, people cringe with this. And I go, no, you don't need to bash. What if they play differently? You know, what if they share the whatever it is, the bit of meat between the two dinosaurs, or the, you know, but I would do that, you know, consciously, you know, as some sort of effort to try and nurture empathy. And I do think it has an impact. Yeah. And those small little things can have an impact.
Absolutely, it does. And I think, you know, no more than, you know, we do it with our children, you know, even if they're bashing our foot with our train, that we don't yell at them, we say, you know, please don't bash my foot with your train, and thank you for not bashing my foot. So we're using the please and thank you. It's not always what we say, it's how we say it. And don't forget, children are mostly, especially the younger ones under 7, developmentally now, not chronologically, because I mean, you may well have a 9-year-old who's emotionally 6, go with that, you know, developmental age. And, you know, they do their communication rather than speak it. If you want to know what's going on inside your young child's mind, how they're feeling, the worst thing we can do, you know, when they've had school and they've been answering questions all day, and we get them in the car and the first thing we say is, you know, how was school? What'd you do? Who'd you see? Where'd you go? And they're just like, shut down, nothing. Yeah. Don't know. And you're like, oh my gosh, what's going on in there? But actually, if we try to connect with them in a doing way, and just for me, what I like to do is play like jelly and ice cream. So it's a game where I would say jelly and you say ice cream, but you have to say it the same way that I do. So if I yell jelly, you would yell ice cream, or if I whisper it, you whisper it, and we go up, down and make funny voices. And if you do that before you ask any questions, you're co-regulating with your child, you're connecting with them. If you've got a child who's very flat, start whispering jelly and bring them up. If your child comes in and they're bouncing off the ceilings, you know, start high and yelling and bring it down. But you're basically seeing yourself as an emotional thermostat to set the heat of the room, rather than a thermometer that just measures it. Because if you measure it, you'll match it. And I think if we can do that, that's not just nice games to play. These aren't just nice activities to do. And it helps our children. We're actually teaching them in a doing rather than saying way, I understand what's going on for you, and I can help you through this feeling.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's a lovely idea, and lovely in theory, Joanna. Lovely in theory, but
going horribly wrong, break out with bubbles and just blow bubbles, because no matter how old they are, there's something you can do with bubbles.
I feel like saying, going into my inner, you know, Irish dad, would you feck off? You sound so American, like, you know, what do you think we're like here, you know? I tell him, get out in that garden, get out in the park and run around a bit. Yeah.
Well, actually do that, like definitely do that. I mean, gosh, get them outside, wrap them up and bouncing around. You have access to an outdoors at the moment, you know, you're privileged, use it.
Yeah, yeah. No, and there are parks around, you know, even in parts. I know it's hard for people, but I do really, really believe in the power of outside and the power of nature.
Too.
And, you know, even within our urban spaces, you know, I live in the city as well. And, you know, there are parks around and you just get into them and you'll find bits of nature. And kids just, it's unreal how naturally they just connect with nature, and it gives them an out, and they get that run around. And, you know, it's so so valuable. But listen, Joanna, I could absolutely talk to you for hours and hours and listen to you. You are really wonderful. Will you just explain to listeners briefly, just in terms of your own books and what you have on your website and where people can go to?
Absolutely.
To find out.
Yeah. So 15 Minute Parenting are the books. There's three. There's 0 to 7 years, 8 to 12 years. And the most recent one is The Teenage Years. And it's really about really what I've been talking about. You know, it's about a roadmap for strengthening and enhancing our relationships with our children at the various stages by using playful and creative communication. And it sounds like, you know, 15 minute parenting, don't I wish I'd crack that and all we had to do was 15 minutes a day and job done. But of course, parenting is 24/7. But this is about mindful, present bursts of play with no distractions, no phones, being super present for 15 minutes and using very selected play activities. So it's play with an agenda, you know, a parenting agenda. And there's lots of ideas in that. And I have also 15 Minute Parenting, the podcast. But yeah, I'm on social media like yourself. You'll find me, Joanna Fortune, on the various platforms. So yeah, by all means, connect with me there.
And your website is Sulliv, isn't it?
It's Sulliv.com.
Sorry.
And you know, I have links to everything up there as well.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining me on Reboot, and I would love to have you back if you'd come back.
Oh, absolutely. It was a pleasure. It was just like a really nice chat. The time went so quickly.
Great. Well, listen, I know our listeners will have got a lot out of it too. And as I said, I'm going to hold you to that commitment of coming back.
Commitment.
So, yeah. See how I changed it from a lovely
ass. Yeah, I did. That was I mean, I almost missed that. Yeah.
And if our listeners do have any questions, as I said, they can contact myself. I could put them to you at the next one, or, you know, as themes and issues they want to raise, because it is going to be a very challenging time in the coming period. And parenting is always a challenge. And a learning journey as well, a nurturing journey, of course, is what we need to call it. And of course, you know, it doesn't need to be said that, you know, we absolutely, our children are magical, wonderful, and they give us, you know, so many wonderful moments. And really all this is trying to do is to try and enhance, you know, as you say, create a better future for them, a better future for us, and, you know, make us all healthy, rounded, empathetic individuals. And so I will leave it there. And just to remind our listeners that we are an independent podcast. We have no money, no ads, no anything. So we don't fill these podcasts with ads. And we have a little entry. Yes, say hello, Keelan. Say hello.
Hi.
Hi, Keelan.
The five-year-old has just wandered in. Yes. Tell everybody.
I am bitten.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Well, playing a game and Ashton was being me and she was pretending my...
So it was a pretend, though. It was a pretend. Aaron is the one-year-old. Okay.
No, Aaron bit me.
Okay, that was terrible.
Oh, my goodness. She must think she's a dinosaur.
Yes, that's probably it. Exactly. We're probably playing dinosaurs. they were playing shark, not dinosaur.
There
okay,
you go.
There we go now. And I was going to finish. Remind listeners, you can support us by going over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Become a patron, support us whatever you can each month so we can keep putting out these podcasts that do cost to produce. And thank you very much, and we'll talk soon.